This is Bernard Stonehouse, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 7th of February 2012. Bernard Stonehouse, Part 4.
How did you get involved in Spry, Bernard?
How did I get involved in Spry? Well, I first went as a visitor when I was going down to... when I was an undergraduate, because I heard... I met Apsley Terry Garrard in London. And it was when I just came back from the Antarctic for the first time and had the emperor penguins story, and I had this idea that it was only the males that were incubating, and I wanted to know if that the ones that they had killed on the colony had been only males. And he said, well, he didn't know. He was a little bit vague, but he was an elderly gentleman by then. This was in one of the clubs in London. I forget where it was now. But he said, well, have you checked any of the ship's logs? Because they occasionally saw emperor penguins and took them on aboard and prepared them as specimens and so on. He said the one that might be most helpful is Worsley's, because they found a lot of... So I went along to the to Spry and got hold of Worsley's report. And I didn't really know enough about the exposition to be able to get my money's worth out of it. But I did, many years later, when I was doing some more work on emperor penguins, as I am at the moment. Anyhow, that was my first encounter with Spry, and then I had it in the back of my mind all the time. I got involved with it when I... more fully, when I'd come back from New Zealand and was I was a senior lecturer and head of a department at Bradford University. I was running courses in environmental science, and I wasn't able to get down to the Antarctic from there. I had no excuse for going, but I got involved with Spry because I visited two or three times to look up particular points of research and got talking to Gordon Mubin and so on. We lived in this house right here in this village in Swarton Bulbeck when I did a 6 month a sabbatical leave at the Scott Polar, when they were just starting up the master's course, the MPhil course, and they took me on as, first of all, as an advisor on it, and then external examiner. So although I was now working at Bradford University, I was able to come out, I had an excuse to come up to Spry every now and again and do a bit of examining or helping with the course and a bit of lecturing and so on. And then when I'd done about 11 or 12 years at Bradford, I decided I was going to take early retirement. They're offering it, and I was one of the first to grab it because I wanted to get some work done, get some Antarctic, get back into Antarctic work,
yeah,
as opposed to running a department and attending a professorial board meetings and God knows what, wasting an awful lot of time. So about the time, at that time, the editorship of the Polar Record came up. So I said, right, well, I'll take my retirement, and I'll draw my pension, and I'll come and we'll come to Cambridge, and I'll edit Polar Record for you, and be able to work. It's a very good reason for working in Spry. And that gave me all the facilities I needed to run students, research students. And I was able to join a French expedition from Spry. They very kindly gave me a few months on Kerguelen Island, where I worked on fur seals, and I was able to join a German expedition, the Winter Weddell Sea Project, where we spent late winter and spring in the winter, I'll see on a German icebreaker, and so on. So I was able to get back into field work through Spry, and then the whole business of the tourism came up. That was, I think, in about 1990, I got my first offer to go down to the Antarctic as a lecturer on board. And it was then that I realised here was a whole new field of research opening up. It was an industry starting up in the Antarctic, and nobody was studying it or working on it. And it was a very good excuse for taking students down. So I was able to run, I was able to do polar record editing, which I did for, I think, about 10 years. But at the same time, I had this field program, which I was, and I was able to, I think we got over a dozen PhDs and master's degrees out of it with the students I was able to take down, and some of them have now gone on and are working in the industry itself. And, it was a very, very profitable time for me, and it gave me 3 or 4 months in the Antarctica every year. We set up bases here and there to study what tourists did when they came ashore, and we set up one or two long-term projects to see what effects, if anything, this was having on the the penguins populations that were being visited every year.
Were there any surprises?
Well, one surprise was at one base we set up, we declared one end of the island and the penguin colonies off limits, and the other one was the area that all the tourists were visiting. We didn't even go to the far end ourselves, except once to count the number of breeding birds, and then at the end of the season to count the number of chicks that were going away. And we were doing the same in the control area as well. And we found that the breeding success was actually higher where the penguins were being visited every day by tourists than it was in the control area down the other end. Well, of course, if it had been the other way around, everybody would immediately have said, of course, it's the tourism that's upsetting the penguins. But in fact, I don't think they had the slightest influence on it either way. No, we got a lot of information. We got a lot of information about how birds behave, all kinds of birds behave in areas which are being visited. Some birds, the Dominican gulls, for instance, you can't do anything about. You just have to keep out of their colonies if you don't want to disturb them. Mm. Their giant petrels are terribly sensitive to visits, and we said in our guidelines, don't go anywhere near giant petrels if you want to keep your reputation for not disturbing birds, for conservation. And people took notice of this because these were unbiased opinions. We were not, and on the whole, we were saying, well, IATO had put out guidelines which were drawn up by a group of naturalists on very sensible lines. But we said, well, we ought to test those. We ought to test those guidelines. So we went through them systematically and tested them. Now, some parties were going ashore in groups of 10 or 20 and staying together as groups of 10 or 20 with a lecturer in charge. Others were letting the tourists wander through the colonies. They don't go within 15 feet of a penguin and so on. Everything will be all right. Now, which of those is the better? rather to our surprise, we found that the guided tours were probably more disruptive than not. And I think it is that if you're walking around a colony slowly and quietly, you're just another penguin. But if something with 20 heads and 40 legs comes through, a lot of people are chattering about the hairdresser back in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and so on. That's something penguins haven't seen before, and that is disturbing. They don't get up and run, but we were monitoring the heartbeat and things like that. We had some bugged eggs while they were sitting on the nest. We were recording the heartbeat through the eggs. And a party going through, it didn't disturb the penguins, but it aroused their interest. Yeah, and you could see them taking, what the hell is this? I haven't seen one of those before. No, it's probably all right, then they go back to sleep. But that's using up energy, which on the whole they can't afford when they're incubating. And so on. We were doing that sort of. And so we were testing the guidelines, and we were testing one or two other propositions that had been put out about conservation in Antarctica. And drawing our conclusions from it, from all this. So this is very profitable.
There's a story about that time of the search for the food source for a colony of emperor penguins. You were doing water column tests, which were proving to be almost empty of food, and yet there was
a
substantial number of emperor penguins breeding on the spot. They must be getting their food from somewhere.
Yes, that was the Polarstern expedition, the Winterwood LC project. We were October, November, and accepted wisdom was that there was nothing at all. The sea at that time of the year was empty of a plankton. And we were going in the icebreaker, going through the ice and putting down nets of all kinds, big nets and little nets and plankton nets and fishing nets and God knows what, because the Polar Stern could turn itself into a trawler when it needed to. And we weren't catching anything at all, and so this was going along with accepted wisdom. But whenever we... Every now and again, we came across an emperor penguin colony of, say, 20,000 penguins who were feeding their chicks. And then we'd see 400 seals. We were overflying in helicopters. We'd see 400 seals with pups, and they were obviously fat and prosperous. So they all knew something that we didn't. And we had to find out what it was, and we found out more or less by accident. We had a machine with cameras on it that you could send down into the sea and move around. Use them for inspecting the legs of oil rigs and things like that. And all the lights and the lenses were pointing downwards so that you were examining the seabed. And then we got the idea, well, let's turn the whole thing upside down and have a look under the sea ice. And of course, that's where everything was. That's where all the action was. And the sea ice itself was draped with phytoplankton, with the plants alive. And then among it was the krill and the... They're like mites in cheese, all the interstices underneath the ice. And that's where the fish were, and that's where the penguins and the seals were hunting. But we weren't catching anything in the nets, because you never put a net down under sea ice, because you'll tear it to pieces. So that was a marvelous discovery. I think it taught us all an awful lot.
I've got some questions from other people, including Ken Blakelock. Not exclusively, Ken.
Yep.
Which is more to do with your feelings about the Antarctic, I think, probably. Let me just say tell you what he says. Ken and yourself, you're sledging over sea ice from Stonington towards Nenny Island one autumn day to go and do some seal culling. And Bernard commented to me, "Remember this day."
Oh.
"And I have done for 50 years," says Ken.
Good Lord.
Do you remember that day?
Yes, I do.
Describe it to me.
It was just a gorgeous day. I expect we'd had a spell of bad weather, and now we had one of the lovely days that you get. Everything was absolutely pristine and marvellous. It would have been a sunny... The sun would have been up, and the shadows and the ice and everything else, and Well, we felt very lucky to be alive and very lucky to be seeing something like this that we hadn't seen before and were unlikely to see again in later life. So.
What was your favourite non-British base?
Arkhstovsky, the Polish base. Would,
why was that?
Because it was run very much on the lines of my old, of our old bases. It was a homely, small base for about 10 or 12 people. They were very pleasant company. They took us, myself and a couple of students, in and looked after us very well and allowed us to join in the base life. Small base, curtains at the windows, out in the open on a lovely setting in Admiralty Bay. And this very interesting surrounds and a lot of very nice people who were only too pleased to... That we were pleased to help them with what they were doing and they were very pleased to help us. So I was there for the purpose of seeing how they could cope with the increasing numbers of tourists that they were getting. They wanted to continue getting them, mm-hmm. but they were getting so many that they were beginning to interfere with the work of the base, and so I was there to advise them and to set up projects to divert the people so that they will still get their money's worth going around the base, but not necessarily through it, particularly at mealtimes and things like that. So we were helping them, they were helping us, and it was the sort of base I understood and enjoyed very much.
Compare that to the Russian base on King George Island or the Brazilian base at Admiralty Bay.
Well, the Brazilian base at Admiralty Bay, that was where you got the best parties in Antarctica. But to live at that rate, at that pace, with a bunch of very lively Brazilians, it would have exhausted me completely, I would think. They were... I was terrified when I was in it because it was an absolute fire trap. They had no concept of I knew bases that had burnt down because they'd let snow build up around the windows and so on. So if you got a fire in it, nobody could get out. And that was just such a base. It was very uncomfortable from that point of view. They're lovely people, absolutely delightful. They're all colours of the rainbow, as Brazilians tend to be. Very noisy, very cheerful. And I say, lovely barbecue parties, but I don't think I could have done much work there.
The Russian base at King George Island?
I went through it and it seemed to me very much a sort of barracks. I think they probably had a much... visiting a base, you never really get the feel of it. You have to live there for a day or two to get the feel of it. I just felt it was a bit like the big American bases, very impersonal and not very comfortable. I always reckon any fool can go to the Antarctic and be uncomfortable, and the way to be comfortable is to make it as much like home as you can. And there's nothing homely about them at all.
What do you remember about playing practical jokes on Bunny Fuchs?
Oh, well, I'm sure you'll have all sorts of... Yes, he tended to be a bit serious-minded and needed his leg pulling every now and again. He was always very responsive to it. You're probably thinking of the boat race. You'll have heard of
it. There are two in here, but yeah, the boat race is one of them, certainly.
Well, you know all about that, don't you? Or you've had a count of that. It was simply that it was boat race tonight, and he was guiding about how Cambridge was bound to win, so we put the clocks forward because he was going to listen to the BBC account of it. So we put the clocks forward and ran our own account of it. It was myself and somebody else in the engine room, so that was a helicopter. We were overhead in the helicopter. And Raymond Glendening or somebody in a quieter corner saying his piece. And, I forget what happened, but I think the Cambridge boat sank on that occasion. And he was getting more and more agitated, and we were getting more and more... We were finding this more and more hilarious. Anyhow, it was a good one.
And another one about the governor's plan to dismantle the American base. Does that ring any bells?
Oh, yes, we got a lot of sort of pompous instructions through from the colonial office and from the governor, some of which were almost unbelievable. So much so that we occasionally simply went off the air and said, sorry, we can't hear you, and I got on with whatever we were doing. But this was a party of some kind. We decided we'd pull Bunny's legs, so we sent him a mail in cipher. We took the trouble to put it into a code. And then it came in, and then we had to decipher it. And we said, hey, Bunny, there's something very funny here. This is from the governor. He said, oh, what is it? I said, well, it's about the American base. And he said, well, right, and we said, it's marked secret. So he said, oh, well, I'd better do the deciphering. So and then we saw him turning purple, and it was... I think the instruction was to take the base down and pack it up and ready to take to some other site. But of course, completely spurious. There was no way on earth we could have moved that base. It was thoroughly frozen in. So.
Was the idea not to erect it on the Larsen ice shelf?
Quite probably, yes. that would have been a lark too.
Could Bunny take a joke?
Sorry?
Could Bunny take a joke?
Something like that, yes. That appealed to him. Once he realised that he was having his leg pulled, that was absolutely fine. He was sometimes a bit slow. He wasn't good at badinage. He wasn't good at the sort of a chai iking. That wasn't his scene at all. But something like that, something with a little bit upmarket and a little bit well thought out and
clever.
Yeah, he liked that very much.
I noticed this Christmas you can buy localised versions of Monopoly, but you seem to have had your own 60 years ago.
Yes, we did, that's right. I don't remember any detail of it, but we did. We made a Monopoly board with local. I wonder what happened to it. No, I don't remember. We sometimes gave a. We got very much stuck into something like that. I remember when the people came in, sledged in from Hope Bay, and there were, I think, 14 of us at the base, which was really only for 11. We were a bit crowded, but it was right at the end of the season. We were waiting for the ship to come in. And somebody said something about pop-up boats. Now, do you remember pop-up boats? They're little tin boats that had a boiler in them and with a vibrating top. You put a candle underneath, put water in, put the candle underneath, and the top, as soon as it boiled, it started vibrating, and that drove the boat forward. These were a toy. And we had a couple of engineers at the base and so on, and I think I may have said, well, I once had a pop-up, but well, what's a pop-up? Oh, well, it... And I said, I wonder if we could make one. And so we got out all kinds of tins and cut. You had all these chaps very solemnly sitting around the table cutting up cigarette tins to make a pop-up boat. And we could never agree on how... Everybody had an idea of how they worked, but nobody could actually think of how we could make one. Well, we must have spent 3 days... Three or four quite serious, well-qualified engineers sitting around a table trying to make pop-up boats out of bits and pieces. And there's another occasion when somebody mentioned pikelets. Now, do you know pikelets?
The little sort of
Little sort of bun with a very rough surface and a very smooth surface underneath. Well, how do you make a pikelet? And we sort of theorised about it. Well, obviously, it's something you make in a pan, and because the two surfaces are so different, it must be something, a bun that you cut in half, and the big holes must be made by yeast. So we all sit down and try to make pikelets. Well, we spent 3 or 4 days, everybody, very seriously, working out how to make pikelets. We never succeeded. We could make things that were vaguely like them, but didn't have anything like the texture that we all recognised and all had ideas about. And things like that, you know, these are all ways in which you pass the time.
You served on the two base leaders in the 1940s. One was Bunny himself and one was Ken Butler.
Mm.
What was the difference in their base leader styles?
Chalk and cheese, I would say. Ken Butler was a... Well, he was a radio operator. He'd been in the Royal Signals. He'd been at the relief of Norway and so on. He'd had quite an interesting war, and he was a bit of a pirate. And basically, he was they were both selfish in that they both wanted to make this. Leading an Antarctic base was going to be the keynote of what they did in the future. Now, Ken was very insecure because he didn't have much of a future, and he didn't know what he was going to do in the future. Mm. He'd been in the army, I think, for 7 years, 6 or 7 years, because he joined up before the war even. But he wasn't going back into the army because he wouldn't have had the seniority and things he needed. So he wanted to make a reputation, and that was what he was focusing on. He was very amiable, very agreeable. He was a lot of fun. He was a nice chap. I'm very glad to have been with him for a year. He was fine. Now, Bunny Fuchs came along was as about as different as he could be. He was very well organised. He was a academic, a geologist. He'd been in the army for 4 or 5 years. He was a territorial before things started in the Cambridge Regiment. He'd been to Cambridge before that, and I got his doctorate. He was a German background. His father was German, and had been interned during the war. He'd become a town major at the end of the war in Germany in the army of occupation himself. And he had military discipline was his idea of running. I mean, if you have a dozen chaps, you impose a sort of discipline, or something, which we hadn't had before. We were all ex-service, but we all knew how to dodge that sort of thing. And I must say, for the first couple of months, we had quite a job training him not to. A treatise like a squad. Very well intentioned, didn't know how, very often didn't know any other way of getting on to people. I think we taught him a lot, and he certainly taught us a lot. And it was perfectly amicable. We didn't have any quarrels or anything like that. We never did at the base at all. Some bases I know had a lot of quarrels between the people and so on. We never did. We didn't at all in the whole of the 3 years, and under all sorts of pressures.
Mm.
The bases were that base was as pleasant an atmosphere as I could have ever hoped to have found myself in, with some very fine people. But they were just two completely different kinds of people, and we had to get used to the difference. And in each case, we had to train them. We, because they were the leaders, we could see their faults and we could see their good points. Mm. But there were 3 very agreeable years from the sort of social point of view.
What are your feelings about BASS? Because you started off as a member of the FIDS, as it was,
yes.
And then you went off and did other things, and then to Spry. And I'm wondering whether you have any sense of loyalty towards Bass, any sense of thankfulness.
I'm very thankful to some of the people I met on Bass, on Fids. And I've no time at all for the organisation of Fids, as it was. It was run by, I think, some very incompetent people when it was being run. But I mean, there was nobody any better that who could have. Right, it was a branch of the Colonial Office, and
you're talking about the 50s now, 40s.
I'm talking about Fids in the 1940s. But people like James Wordy, who'd been on Shackleton's expedition. There was, what's his name, Brian Roberts, who was a sort of guru, who had been on the British Graham Land expedition. They were ex-Antarctic people, but they were... Well, we didn't appreciate the problem at the time, but of course they were running they were being run by a political masters. Mm. I think FIDS was set up, or Operation Tabarin was set up in the 1940s, not, as everybody says, to keep the Argentines out of Antarctica, but to keep the Americans out of Antarctica. The Argentines didn't have any bases. The Americans did have a base, and they had Admiral Byrd, who was trying very hard to get the Americans to take over Antarctica as a whole. Have I been through this with you before?
No.
Well, he was the one who first invented the idea of a permanent station, which is being replaced, where the personnel are being replaced every year or every 2 years or so on. And that was the point of the base on Doddington Island, and had another one, of course, over in Little America on the Ross Sea side. Now, his views were repudiated by the American government, which was why that particular expedition ran for only 1 year, and then Congress simply cut the funding for it. But the threat was there, and of course that got the Brits on their toes. This was 1941-42, and it also stirred up the Argentines and the Chileans, because he'd chosen to put this base down in the place where three nations were already competing for ownership. So, but the immediate threat was, as I say, not the Chileans, not the Argentines, but the Americans. Well, we couldn't admit that at the time, because the Americans were on our side, they were the arsenal of democracy, which meant that they were selling the arms to us instead of to the Germans. But there's no evidence of this available now. I've been trying to chase up all the archival material on this, and it's simply disappeared. But I'm pretty certain that the people who were running Bass, were running Operation Tamarin and then FIDS, were in a sort of dilemma about this. And they had to blame, they had to say, well, of course it's the Argentines and the Chileans were keeping out. Well, ultimately it didn't matter. What mattered was how they ran the operation. And they were absolutely hopeless. I mean, the ships they were operating simply weren't up to the job. They said, well, of course, in our time we had wooden ships, so you have to have a wooden ship if you're going through the... And this was despite the fact that the Americans and everybody else had icebreakers that... No, they had to have a wooden ship, so they got a wooden ship. Well, what wooden ships were going? Well, the ones that were used for magnetic mine and used in harbours for boom defence vessels and things like that. So they got one of those, and it was absolutely bloody hopeless because it leaked like a sieve and was underpowered and so on. And that was what they took us down to the Antarctic and then, of course, couldn't get us out. What aircraft should we take down? As I said, once we got rid of the Austerfall, oh well, in the BGLE we used a Tiger wasn't a tiger moth. It was a gypsy moth, which is just the next size up. So they had to get a gypsy moth and send that down. Well, they sent it down, but they packed the skis in another set of packing, so the skis never got... I think the skis got to Marguerite Bay, but the aircraft itself didn't. So we didn't have an aircraft for the next... for the 2 years, the following 2 years. And so on. It was all... You began to realise that these people were all part-time. It was a sort of part-time operation. They weren't really giving much attention to what they're doing. I mean, James Wordy was master of Cambridge College. Brian Roberts was in the Foreign Office and was helping to put together the Antarctic Treaty and things like that. It was a hopeless... I mean, we were being run by some very incompetent people. Well, then we saw that gradually building up into... I think there was a time... I sat down once and worked out in the... When I got back in the early 1950s, there was... Or in the 1950s, you can check this in Bunny Fuchs's book, there was something like 10 bases... run by three people in London. Well, now you've got one base run by about 600 people. of course, with all the stages in between that, there was a time when everybody was putting down bases as fast as they could, and sometimes putting them down in completely wrong places because it was left to the ship's captain to put them down. He could see where it was easy to offload stores and take them on board again, but he couldn't see whether what would happen in the winter when people wanted to work around the place. I couldn't get out of it in the way around, and so on. It's always been. And I was never able to work with it later because I work on a completely different scale. My job in the Antarctic is to take a small number of people down and work on them intensively and get them doing the research in a small base, in very small units, as economically as you can. And if I joined Bass to do what I was doing, and that was a possibility at one stage when Bass was compelled by the government to cooperate with universities. This was about the time I was starting up, and I went along to see them about it. They said, well, what do you want to do? And I say, well, I want to work. I'm studying tourism. They say, yes, but what's your project? I said, well, I don't know, because I'm still working. I'm going down and finding out what needs to be done. Is it cutting edge of science? No, it isn't, but it's very good training for students. Well, they have to compete for funding with other bodies in Britain, and they have to represent themselves as a cutting edge of science. That phrase came up. My job is training students in fieldwork, and that's quite a different proposition because there's no cutting edge of science in it, but there's some very, very good training in it.
There's a future cutting edge.
So that was... And then they would say, well... I would say, well, now I want to be able to guarantee to get a student down there every year for 2 years because they're doing the PhDs and so on. Well, of course, your projects would have to take their turn with everybody else's, and there would be times when we might take them down, but we couldn't get them into your place because we've been held up elsewhere. And I said, well, that's no good to me because PhD students don't have that sort of option available to them. So I got all my logistics done through the cruise operators themselves, who are only too pleased to take down... To cooperate, to help, to take down parties of students and land them. And then we get the stories from them at the end, and which was very nice for the passengers because they would feel that they were involved too, and we got them involved where we could and so on. So I've always worked on a different scale. it came to the fore when I said, well, I'm going to use Zodiacs, little Zodiac. And they said, well, if you're taking a Zodiac, you have to take a, you have to have a boat master. And I said, no, all my students will have a training in Zodiac. We'll go up to the first or fourth and get that certificate, training in Zodiac handling. I will be there for at least a month with them, teaching them what I know about it. And they'll be using them not only to get around from here to there for scientific purposes, they'll be using them for recreation as well, because that's when you get to know how to handle boats. Mm. Well, this was another language from the language that Bass has to use with it, all its requirement to follow government guidelines on this, that and the other, and so on. Now, I claim that my system is a great deal safer. And I've seen boats used at a Bass basis that I wouldn't go across the Serpentine in, little aluminium boats without any. Whereas all my students, I said, well, what happens if the boat, if the boatmaster goes over the side? Oh, well, no, the boatmasters never do. That's why the boatmaster. I said, well, all my students are going to be competent operators. They're going to know how to fix the engine if it goes wrong, how to tow one boat with another. And so we're going to do all that, and that's as safe as you'll get. And so for all these different small reasons, I've never found any cause to go back into Bass or work with them.
Does that amount almost to an animosity towards them, or just a...
No, not at all. I'm very glad that I've been able to do everything that I... I've been able to do far more on my own, or doing it my way.
You had the freedom to do what you want to do.
Well, the freedom to take opportunities. Mm-hmm. The opportunities were there, and I was able to take them, and I had the freedom to do that. You see, they had only one or two boats operating in the Antarctic. I there were some years where I had a choice of 30, and I could call up one ship and say, look, I've got somebody here that I would like to have at another of my bases. Would you be able to? Are you calling in? Are you anywhere near us? Are you calling in? Could you pick him up and take her, or her, and take her to this other base? And I say yes, no trouble at all. They'd have two or three days aboard the ship. They'd pay their way by giving a talk on what they were doing and so on. Everybody was happy. So I had a much wider choice that way.
Final question. You experienced the Antarctic in three different ways: once as an independent, once through Spry, and once through Bass.
Through Fitz,
I beg your pardon, yes. What's your feeling about the next few years for the Antarctic? Do you have any concept of how things are going to be over the next few years? Are you worried about it environmentally? Are you worried about it administratively? Ecologically?
Well, I don't worry about it at all, because I've got it. There's some things I worry about and some things that I don't. And I don't. No, I'm very much out of Antarctic research now. I'm not touching tourism anymore. I'm already way behind. I was asked to write a paper on something about it the other day, and I had to say no. I'm 2 years out of date on it, and that's a long time because things are changing all the time. I think the science is getting so advanced and so specialised and so expensive that one nation after another is going to say we can no longer afford this, or we can no longer afford it at this scale or that scale or whatever. And so I think the amount of scientific research coming out of it, of new scientific research, is going to be very much diminished. And the funding will now go to the long-term programs, which can very often be run automatically or without people involved, which is the expensive element. which is a change in emphasis, but we always complained in the old days that you could never get a long-term operation going because no grant would ever guarantee you more than about 3 years at the most. And if you wanted to do a 20-year research project, you had to do it starting out as a 3-year project and hope that you could pick up the money on the way. I think now you're getting a lot of projects in which are run by technicians or are run from Britain by radio or God knows what, or the satellites and so on, which is quite a different game. It doesn't suit me because my business is training people, or has been, to work in the Antarctic and all that goes with that, work independently, work in new fields. That's where my emphasis has been. I think there's going to be less and less opportunity for that. Which is fair enough. There'll be opportunities for people to sit in the offices at home and do Antarctic work from home. It won't be half as much fun as far as I'm concerned. I mean, it would bore me stiff. But these are all very necessary changes. I think tourism is probably levelling out a bit now. I think the Antarctic Treaty is beginning to get a little bit more relevant to what Antarctica actually needs. The main business of those involved in the Antarctic Treaty has been to keep the Antarctic Treaty going. I mean, the hell with Antarctica, it's to keep the treaty itself going, which is a very necessary thing to do, because there were several occasions when the Antarctic Treaty was beginning to look like quite an unnecessary expense. Well, I think it's established itself now, and it can pay more attention to the Antarctic's own, the problems of Antarctica itself. It still has nowhere near the powers that it requires to control Antarctica. Well, there's no police, there's no policing, there's no. It's impossible to. To afford to police the seas, for example, to see that the results from the fisheries. It's impossible to control the fisheries and so on because it's simply there isn't the money, there isn't the motivation to do it. So I'm concerned about. Well, I'm beyond concerned now because I think they've already wrecked the Antarctic fisheries are almost completely wrecked anyway, everywhere, certainly compared with what they were what was available 20 years ago, as they have all over the world. It's just no different in Antarctica. I'm not worried about the. You can't sit and worry about the ice, about the. About the ice shelves breaking away, because all right, they're breaking away, and there's nothing I can do about them. Anybody else, for that matter, we might be able to do it if we cut down the carbon, whatever it is. But there's nothing to do in the Antarctic itself about this, except monitor it and take an interest in what's happening if we're capable of doing that, and we have all the technology for doing that, so it'll be done. It'll be very interesting to know what's there when the ice is gone, but that again is not a thing I shouldn't worry about.
A whole new continent.
Well, very, very probably, yes. Mm. Then we'll probably make just as much mess of that as we have every other one. Apart from that, no, I have no.
Good. Well, let's leave it there. But thank you very much indeed for your time.
Good.